Thank you for joining me today for another episode of Law and Religion Down Under. My name is Jeremy Patrick, your host. The intersection between faith and the legal system is a fascinating one, and this bi-monthly podcast is devoted to exploring the myriad of ways that can manifest. Each episode of Law and Religion Down Under features an interview with a different guest. The topic for this episode is Queensland's new law on voluntary assisted dying, which passed the Queensland legislature last month and will take effect on January 1st of 2023. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by the Reverend Dr. Adam McIntosh, a minister in the United Church, to discuss voluntary assisted dying. My guest chaired the Queensland Synod's consultation group that prepared a report on the issue in 2019, and he is also a board member of Meaningful Aging Australia. Adam, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Great to be with you, Jeremy.
So as I often do on these podcasts, I thought I would start with sort of the most basic question, because we have listeners who may know a lot and some listeners who may know very little. So I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit, what is voluntary assisted dying? How does it differ from other terms we often hear, euthanasia, suicide, and so forth?
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. It's an important question, and it's a question that we grappled with as part of our initial consultation. So it's definitely related to other terms such as euthanasia. Often people use the language we found, certainly in the Australian context, of euthanasia and suicide when they already have a particular ethical position on it, and usually it sort of has negative connotations. Around the globe, there's various terms that are used. So you've got medical assisted dying as an example in Canada, where in parts of the United States you have physician-assisted suicide. So there's different terms used. So what it means in the Australian context is we've really landed on a particular approach to euthanasia, which we use the language around voluntary assisted dying. So each word has a particular, gives meaning to it. So the voluntary aspect of voluntary assisted dying is essentially, it's about a person giving consent. So they're active decision makers in this process. It's also the legislation, any legislation around voluntary assisted dying is also has the element of acting without coercion. So that's another meaning, part of the meaning of voluntary. So any safeguards of the legislation really sort of deal with that issue of coercion and trying to minimise that. And the final aspect of the voluntary element of it is decision-making capacity, which again is a legal term. And in most jurisdictions, capacity is assumed. We don't need to prove decision-making capacity, but we need to disprove whether or not a person doesn't have capacity. So that's the voluntary element of it. So when we talk about assisted, what we're talking about is either a person is assisted to self-administer, which in most cases is seen to be the normative practice around voluntary assisted dying, or a person is assisted where they cannot undertake the act themselves by a medical practitioner who would administer a voluntary assisted dying substance. So the dying component is really about the intention is to end a person's life. So it's definitely connected to the whole euthanasia debate. You may remember sort of we used to have terms such as voluntary active euthanasia, involuntary.
Yes, yes.
So I think this really gives clarity what we mean by this part of the debate in the Australian context.
Okay, I think that's really helpful for sort of setting the scope around this, that this is, as you say, the voluntary element requires affirmative consent. This isn't the withdrawal of life support from someone who's in a coma, you know, for something like that. This is someone who is affirmatively asking for this to happen. We also hear in this debate a lot about palliative care. What is palliative care? How does that relate to this? How do they fit together?
It definitely relates to it, and a lot of the debate is really around palliative care and treatment of people at the end of life and suffering. So it's important to understand that the legal framework prior to voluntary assisted dying, which still exists in most jurisdictions in Australia. So there's two elements of it. One is a withdrawal of treatment. So a medical practitioner is not obligated to continue treatment if there's medical futility or what they call non-beneficial care. So withdrawal of treatment is not voluntary suicidine, but it sometimes can be confused with it. So it's really down to the intention. The intention of the act is not to hasten death, but to provide comfort care, and to do that by withdrawing particular treatment. The other element that's sometimes connected to the whole palliative care conversation is really hastening death through relieving suffering. So this is where essentially a medical practitioner provides pain medication to people, but the intention is really the critical issue here. The intention is to relieve their suffering. So there's this what they call the doctrine of double effect, which is a legal term, but also an ethical term, which is essentially the principle is used to justify cases where a doctor might give treatment in, say, a palliative care situation to relieve suffering of various forms, but the outcome of that treatment is to shorten the patient's life. So it's relieving suffering, but hastening death occurs. And that's a fairly common practice in palliative care. But what's the significant legal and ethical distinction is the intent. So with voluntary and suicidine, the intent is to end life. We're relieving suffering and hastening death, which absolutely we should do in high quality palliative care. The intent is to relieve suffering, and the side effect may be the hastening of death. So just getting clarity around those terms, I think, is important, because that's often, people are often very confused around what do we mean by voluntary assisted dying, what do we mean by withdrawing treatment and hastening death. And there's important distinctions ethically and legally as well.
So someone who had access to palliative care could still request voluntary assisted dying under this legislation?
Absolutely, they can, yes.
And you mentioned different terms in different countries, and I know we're going to talk a lot about the Queensland law specifically. So some other countries have laws of this type, and some other states in Australia have also already passed laws for voluntary assisted dying. Could you tell me a little bit about, at least within Australia, how those laws are working? Are they seem to be effective, safe, or have they been deemed to be problematic?
It's very interesting, because in Australia we're really very early on. So Victoria was the first state to implement a voluntary assisted dying scheme in Australia, and that's only been operating since June 2019. So we do have some data coming in, but I suspect it's fairly early. So some interesting information though that does confirm what's happening internationally as well. What we know in Victoria from its most recent report, so there's a voluntary assisted dying review board that does give annual reports, and the most recent report was in June 2021. And what they have in that is some interesting data around those who have undertaken the voluntary assisted dying process, and then those who actually have died taking the prescribed medication. I think this is an important point around decision-making capacity and consent. So in Victoria, just to give you some numbers, since the scheme has started, 836 people have been assessed as eligible for voluntary assisted dying. So they're going through all the process. They can take the substance at any point. They've been approved to undertake voluntary assisted dying. And yet those who have actually gone ahead and died from taking the prescribed medication is 331. So it's a big gap, and that confirms some overseas trends as well, where overseas the data's come in to say that often people go through the process but do not go through with the act itself. Uh-huh. So they're eligible, they can do it at any point, but they don't actually go through with the act. And overseas, we also have some interesting information about why people undertake voluntary assisted dying. I think this is important in terms of, I suppose, the ethical dimension around voluntary assisted dying, and we can come back to the Queensland law a little later. But it's some data from Oregon in the United States tracked the reason why people wanted to undertake voluntary assisted dying. And often in the Australian debate, it's been around physical pain and relieving pain. But actually overseas, the reasons are what we might describe as more existential pain. So issues, the top rating issue from Oregon between 1998 and 2017 was losing autonomy. So it's that fear of losing autonomy was the biggest reason why people made a decision to undertake voluntary assisted dying. And then it sort of goes down on the list. It's unable to engage activities making life enjoyable, loss of dignity, and then it sort of go burden to family and friends, inadequate pain control is actually second last on the list. And the final aspect is financial implications of treatment, very small percentage. So what that tells us is that the issue is not so much around, in most cases, not so much around relieving physical suffering, but around existential, what we might call existential issues, around how we understand suffering, how we understand our autonomy, how we view dignity. And I think these are sort of societal value issues rather than sort of medical issues. And that's an important distinction, I think, in terms of understanding where Queensland's gone with this legislation, and an important reason why we've argued as a synod that we've been opposed to voluntary assisted dying, saying actually people do have dignity at every stage of life, in every circumstance of life. And we seek to uphold that in what we do in our various services across the state and in our values. But we can come back to that point a little later if you like.
Okay. Well, your earlier point was fascinating, that in Victoria, the experiences of a lot of people who gain access to voluntary assisted dying choose not to, or don't end up actually exercising it. Do you think it's maybe more about having control, or as you say, autonomy, the ability to carry it out, maybe in some cases more important to people than actually choosing to do so?
Yeah, the evidence certainly suggests that. And it's the same evidence overseas, just that sense of, I can, and I've got that as a potential safeguard if things sort of reach that crisis point. That seems to be quite important in the research, and Victoria really, really confirms that. And not surprising, it's sort of that people, it's that foreboding of what might be, that anticipation of I might reach a point, which is really fear. And a whole range of values around that, which gives people that sense of, yeah, I've got this safeguard that if it does reach that point that it's unbearable, I can undertake the act. And that's, yeah, that seems to be a big driver for people.
But just while we're on the topic of Victoria's Law, there was an article in the Sydney Morning Herald over the weekend, I guess a commentary piece by someone, Malcolm Knox. He was writing about Victoria's experience and how, since it came into effect in 2019, how few numerically people have actually died from voluntary assisted dying. And the argument he made was, there may be so many safeguards in place, I think 68 safeguards in the legislation, that it may function to keep a lot of people who would want it from getting it in the time that they have. That the process may be so slow or cumbersome or bureaucratic that it may not be sort of fit for purpose because of all the concern over safeguards. On the other hand, of course, we all know why those safeguards are in place. We don't want this to slide into really problematic territory. So I just found that an interesting article I read over the weekend.
It is interesting, and it's that's a conversation that no doubt will be had in Queensland when it comes into effect here. But I suppose it, for me, it gets down to the core purpose. Is it the exception for unbearable suffering, or is it one of many options at the end of life that people should have access to a choice for? Yes, we can have, and then we have safeguards built around that. My sense is that from an ethical perspective, that it really should be the exception to relieve those unusual circumstances where there are extreme suffering. in those circumstances, you know, if we're going to have a voluntary assisted dying scheme, that should be the core purpose. But if it's broader than that, then that's sort of taking us potentially into where do we draw the line? Mm-hmm. And I think already during the Queensland debate in Parliament, several MPs during the debate were really arguing this point that it's too strict, the safeguards are too strong, that it's going to limit access to it. So even, for example, people with dementia was brought up, which again gets to the heart of the voluntary element and decision-making capacity. If we go down that route, then you're really opening it up to a very different domain. And that's sort of the old slippery slope argument. You know, how far do you open it up? How wide should it go? And fundamentally, as a society, what do we understand its purpose to be?
Exactly. And I guess that a lot of that gets into sort of the policy questions, as you say, about different ways to think about the risks and the availability of it for people in different stages of end-of-life care. Maybe I'll ask, how much do those policy questions, how much did that weigh with the consultation group that you led for the Queensland Synod of the United Church in making your recommendations about whether the church should support or oppose voluntary assisted dying in Queensland? Was it primarily a theological principle sort of opposition, or was it more on the policy evaluation or some of each?
Yeah. At the point of consultation, we didn't have a voluntary assisted dying bill in Queensland to sort of debate. So we undertook the consultation prior to any sort of direction that the state was taking at that point. However, we very much approached the consultation process from the perspective that we are heavily involved in the delivery of aged care and disability and medical services, healthcare, right across the state. So we're involved in hospitals, we're involved in aged care. So very much the question was a question of what happens if there is a voluntary assisted dying scheme and what involvement would we have in that scheme? So we asked questions around, should it be something that is permissible in our facilities? Is it something that our medical practitioners should be involved in? What type of conscientious objection safeguards should we have? So even though we came to a position around, yes, we're in opposition to voluntary assisted dying, it was more around the intersection of our service provision and the implications of that if there was to be a voluntary assisted dying act, which there now is, how would we respond? So our various submissions to the Queensland Law Reform Commission, which was asking some detailed questions around the voluntary assisted dying legal framework, we were very much involved in that conversation, trying to, even though we were opposed to it, contributing in the best way that we could constructively to that. And of course, the most recent parliamentary inquiry around the draft bill as well. So that intersection of what we're involved in the agencies of the Synod, as well as, which really is the detail of the Act, as well as the broader issue around, you know, is this something that we are supportive of or not? Both were embraced in our consultation process. And of course, the question of palliative care sort of fed into that. And as you went further out into the regions, we found that the issue of palliative care was even stronger because people really were experiencing inadequate access to palliative care, and they experienced people suffering unnecessarily at the end of life. So voluntary assisted dying and access to adequate palliative care was a big part of our consultation. And where we landed was that, yes, even though we're in opposition to voluntary assisted dying and we've got a criteria around what would happen if it is legislated, we were committed to advocating for high quality palliative care, access for everybody, especially in the regions in Queensland.
And I think that fits, my understanding is broadly within how most mainstream religious groups in Australia have reacted to voluntary assisted dying. They've come out in opposition on principle, but often their opposition also has some opposition on sort of the policy applications and how it should be done in practice as well. And I do find that a really interesting sort of connection, because what I don't think we have seen is any mainstream religious groups say, theologically, this is wrong, but from a policy perspective, it's a good idea. You know, I mean, you can sort of, it's hard to see any churches or mainstream religious groups saying that. They tend to have joint sort of opposition, both on principle and maybe on the necessity of it in practice. I'm interested in sort of intra-denominationally, was this a challenging issue within the United Church? Were there a lot of sort of sides back and forth, or was it a pretty, was it easy to reach a consensus about the best way to respond?
We did have, so this was, our consultation was focused only on Queensland. So mm-hmm. different states in the United Church have come to different positions. And the Assembly, which is our national body, doesn't have a statement and a position around voluntary assisted dying. I think the consultation process was led to the final report, which was pretty well received. It was strongly endorsed at the Synod meeting. So there wasn't any division at all at the Synod meeting. It was strongly endorsed. And I think because the consultation process meant that we struggled with the details of the issue, particularly as you've just mentioned, the policy detail of it. You know, what would it mean if the state does legislate on this? How are we going to respond? So that became probably a more important question than the question, are we opposed to it or supportive of it? It was really, well, we might be opposed to it, but that's not necessarily going to change the state, in a democratic and pluralistic society, implementing a voluntary assisted dying scheme. But how will we respond, given we have such a large presence in community and health services across Queensland? So I think because that sort of shifted the nuances of the debate, but overall it was well engaged, and you do have different opinions on either end of it, but there was a strong consensus at the what we call the Synod meeting, which is the gathering of the church to make decisions like this. There was strong consensus around that final report. Other states, New South Wales is in the midst of a conversation around this at the moment. Other states have taken different position, but that's what it was like in Queensland.
Well, let's go ahead and turn to Queensland's law specifically. Could you give a sort of general overview of what the procedure is for a patient to be able to request and receive voluntary assisted dying?
Yeah, so there's a range of factors with the Queensland Bill. I suppose the first point is really the most significant part of it, which is really the safeguards of it as well, which is what they call the eligibility condition. So what's the criteria for people to be able to access voluntary assisted dying? And essentially they've got three elements of it, but it's sort of the detail of the elements which is probably most important. So one, you need to have an advanced, progressive and will cause death medical condition. Two, it's expected to cause death within 12 months. And three, causing suffering that the person considers to be intolerable. Now, it's interesting, the whole conversation around what do they mean by suffering, because suffering in the eligibility condition is very much a subjective criteria. So it's what the person considers to be intolerable. They don't need to prove that, it's what they consider to be. It's not a medical assessment of suffering. So when you look into the definition of suffering, they define suffering as physical or mental suffering. Now, they do rule out specifically you cannot access voluntary assisted dying because of a mental illness or mental health issue. So they've ruled that out. So the question becomes, well, what do they mean by mental suffering. It's not mental health. It's not mental illness. So what is it? So my understanding of it is that it's really referring to what we talked about a little earlier around that existential suffering. So those experiences of losing hope and losing dignity and hopelessness and fear and all those elements or physical suffering. So they've really broadened the scope. They've also got a 9-day process as part of it, the assessment process. So the assessment process is a person needs to begin by requesting access to voluntary assisted dying. And then there's a twofold assessment process. So there's a first assessment, which is by what they call a coordinating practitioner. And then that leads to another assessment, which is by the consulting practitioner. If the consulting practitioner finds the person is eligible, then they move on to the next stage, and it leads to a second request, and eventually it reaches a point that they've been approved, but they need to make what they call an administration decision. And at that point, if they've met all the criteria, they will have access to a voluntary assisted dying substance. And then there's two ways that people can undertake voluntary assisted dying. The one is the self-administration, which is considered to be the normal process. It's sort of that practitioner administration is the other option. That should only be if the person cannot self-administer. And then where the Act is quite interesting is that it's actually chosen to legislate to regulate by legislation what they name as non-participating entities, which is essentially institutional conscientious objection. What entities that have an objection to voluntary assisted dying, whatever that might be, can and can't do in relation to different stages of the process. So from the person requesting information, from the person having assessments, from the person making an administration decision to the person undertaking the act. And the legislation also differentiates between two elements, between what they call permanent residence, which essentially is, it would be like a resident in an aged care facility or potentially in a disability facility as well, and non-permanent resident, which essentially refers to most likely our respite or hospital space. So, and there's different requirements in the Act in relation to the different stages of the process for an entity that has opposition to voluntary assisted dying, what they are legally obligated to do and what they have legal rights to do. And I think that's where the issue of institutional conscientious objection and individual rights really comes to the fore. And our position is that they haven't quite got that balance right in relation to institutional conscientious objection and its and the rights of the individual to access a legal service where they are. That's sort of a broad summary of the Voluntary Assisted Dying Act in Queensland.
Well, I want to come back to the conscientious objection in just a moment, but just sort of unpacking the process. So there's my understanding is there's fixed timelines, I guess, for how long each step has to occur. There's different evaluations by medical professionals. There's a sort of medical review board that also gets in play at one stage. And as you say, essentially a patient has to make three separate requests after a certain period of time for each one in order to gain access to the voluntary assisted dying substance. Is that correct?
So it's two requests and then the final step is an administration decision, and which is important in terms of they might go through that, but they might not choose to go ahead.
Right. Okay. And you talked about some of the other safeguards in play. So on the conscientious objection point, I guess we could think of, as you say, institutional conscientious objections, facilities or hospitals run by a religious organization, for example. And then we can think of individual conscientious objections, a particular physician who doesn't want to be involved in this process. Could you talk a little bit about, I guess, each of those cases and what the law provides? And then you mentioned some dissatisfaction with how the law was treating. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
So the Act does differentiate between a medical practitioner or nurse practitioner, which in Queensland, it can be a nurse practitioner that can provide voluntary assisted dying too. They can, they do have a right to a medical practitioner or nurse practitioner do have very strong conscientious rights in the bill, in the Act. So they have a right to refuse to be part of any stage of the process. The only obligation that they do have is if somebody requests information, they do need to give them information about where they're likely to have access to somebody who can provide voluntary assisted dying. Now, the Act has flagged that what they call a voluntary assisted dying navigator scheme, which should make that process fairly straightforward. So if somebody, a medical practitioner, is approached around voluntary assisted dying and they have a conscientious objection, they can state that quite clearly. They do have a conscientious objection and just give information about the navigator service. So that's fairly straightforward, and I think that's a reasonable step. I suspect most people would know how to access that information anyway. So it's whether or not they should be obligated to give information is another question. I don't think it's a big ethical issue. But when it comes down to what they call entity non-participation, now it's interesting they've chosen that language because there's a whole conversation and debate, if you like, around, you know, do institutionals actually have a conscience or not? And therefore, do they have a right to conscientious objection at all? So the language of entity non-participation is used in the Act. So essentially, the different stages of the process from request of information to the assessment process to administration decision. So if you look at just those three to begin with, non-permanent residents, so people in our residential facility, the Act says they do have a right to access that. And in the hospital space, for the assessment process, for non-permanent residents, which is the hospital space, they do have a right to transfer people for the assessment process. Except there is a provision there, what they call, if it is not reasonable to transfer the person, then the person do have rights, even as a non-permanent resident. Now, the reasonability test includes areas like it may cause increased physical suffering. They might lose decision-making capacity. They also, interesting, say things like it might cause death. There might not be a place for people to be transferred to. So the coordinating practitioner, who's the person that does the assessment, is the person in the Act who determines whether it is reasonable for the person to be transferred or not. Now, for permanent residents, there is no such right for entities of transfer at all for those three stages of the process. And we think that is reasonable. Ethically, if somebody is after information or going through an assessment process, that's very different ethically than actually ending their life. So, and we know from the research, a high percentage of people don't actually go through with the Act. So should entities have a right to restrict in such circumstances in terms of right to information, right to assessment, right to make an administration decision? Well, our position was that no, they shouldn't have that right to object. It's but where it gets, I think, the most contentious part of the Act is where somebody undertakes voluntary assisted dying, so the actual ending of a life. So whether that's by self-administration or whether that's a practitioner administration. Now, again, the Act does differentiate between permanent residents and non-permanent residents and rights in that space. So for non-permanent, so in say the hospital situation, an entity that has an objection to voluntary assisted dying that does not provide the service is a non-participating entity, as described in the Act, does have a right of transfer unless, again, it is unreasonable for the person to be transferred for the reasons I mentioned before. Now, for permanent residents, that right doesn't exist at all. So regardless of whether there's no reasonable reasonability test in terms of transfer, the person does have a right to undertake that act despite the entity's conscientious objection. So this is where I think it's most contentious. It's sort of the difference between an assessment process and the ending of a life and the right of an individual to access a legal service and the rights of an entity which is established for a particular purpose and that has clearly a position in regard to voluntary assisted dying. That's part of who they are, part of their mission, part of their values, part of their identity, part of their core purpose. And they will be forced to allow it to happen on their site. And I think that that's where that blurriness and that intersection between the state and religious freedom, I think, very much comes to the fore. And the rights of entities, especially not-for-profits that are faith-based, and that's a high percentage of our community and health services in Australia, the way that we're set up, the rights of them to be able to act out and to live out their values in a way in their facilities. So very much the understanding of the Act is that a facility is somebody's is a place where services are provided, where the many services have set up these facilities. They began essentially as places to offer care for the most vulnerable and to give expression to a core concept that everybody has intrinsic value at every stage and every circumstance of life. So there is no stage of life where that value isn't there, and we will do all that we can to minimise suffering, to uphold the dignity of people. And that's why they were set up in disability and health services and so on. And really, in some circumstances, where somebody has a right to end their life in a way that's contrary to the stated values of an entity, that's where I think that conflict really is, that tension is really there. And it's really about what's the right of an entity to contribute to the common good in society through its social witness, and how does that intersect with the rights of an individual who finds himself in a place receiving services that a majority of which might be funded by the state. What rights does that individual have? And that's what the Act tries to deal with, and it tries to strike that balance. And our sense is it didn't quite get that balance right, particularly at the ending of the life stage of it. Now, that doesn't mean that we would transfer people. In fact, our position is that if it is unreasonable to transfer a person for the reasons I mentioned before, then it may be appropriate to allow that to happen in a facility, even when you have a conscientious objection, where you're erring on the side of compassionately supporting a person. But having that right, I think, is important, particularly in some of our communities where the idea of ending a life is very disruptive to the communities and for staff who hold these values and work for an organisation because of those values. For people who have that those strong religious beliefs and not necessarily religious belief, just have other beliefs around voluntary assisted dying, for them to be in a place, even though they don't need to be involved directly in the Act, to be around that and for it to happen in that site, in their place of work, in a community's home, I think that's really pushing the issue too far. But it's a complicated issue. It's a very complicated issue.
It is, and it sounds like a sort of clash or trying to balance these irreconcilable interests or rights of, as you say, the entity or the institution wanting to be able to fulfill its core religious values, not have outsider, I guess, physicians come in to the facility to carry out voluntary assisted dying for a patient. But then I guess you can see it from the patient's perspective. If they're a long-term permanent resident of an aged care facility, they've been there for years, they may consider it their home, and having to transfer to another facility at the very end stages of their life could be, a very stressful sort of situation to put them in as well, if they want to pass in peace at the place they consider their home, even if it's technically a facility. So it's a difficult balance, as you say, to strike. And I can understand why it's difficult for anybody on either side of that line to be wholly satisfied, I guess, with how the legislation has attempted to do it. Is the Queensland legislation, to your understanding, is it pretty similar to that of other states, or has it sort of forged a different path?
Certainly, in many ways it is similar. And most like WA's legislation, Tasmania sort of follows a similar line to the Victorian Act. The big difference in Queensland is really around this issue of entity non-participation. I mean, there's other differences as well, but there's a lot of similarities. And so most, every other state, in fact, are silent on the issue. They don't address the issue. So in one sense, it's positive that they've addressed the issue. But of course, where you land on that becomes quite a significant conflict potentially if you disagree with that. So that's the most significant difference. I mean, there's other minor differences in terms of timeline. For example, Victoria has a 12-day minimum period for the assessment process. Queensland has 9 days. In Victoria, it's 6 months unless it's motor neuron disease, which is 12 months of expected time frame for a life to end, where Queensland just go on a straight 12 months. So there's subtle differences. Also, the naming of suffering, the spelling out of the detail to say mental suffering. So in Victoria, as I understand it, it's again that subjective determination, but it doesn't broaden that out to include mental suffering. Doesn't rule it out, but it doesn't specify it as well. So there's minor details, minor changes in process and so on. So another one is medical practitioner. In Queensland, it's a nurse practitioner is eligible to qualify somebody to administer voluntary assisted dying. Again, that's mostly because we're such a large state, access to medical practitioners across Queensland may be difficult. So they wanted to broaden that out to nurse practitioners. So there's slight differences. Some would argue they've tightened some areas up. Others would and open other areas up where they're a bit too restrictive in Victoria. But again, it depends where you stand on the whole issue, whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Sure. Well, and I guess looking into the future, I know it's always hard to predict. So we know that all the states now, except for New South Wales, have voluntary assisted dying. From what I understand, they've pushed back a vote until next year. And then the Northern Territory and the ACT still don't have voluntary assisted dying. Do you think this will be a sort of persistent moral issue, persistent sort of source of controversy? I'm thinking of, abortion in the United States, which for 50 years has been enormously politically divisive. Or do you think this will be more sort of like same-sex marriage, where it's very divisive for a little while, but then nowadays you hardly hear any controversy about it? What do you think the future holds for the voluntary assisted dying debate from a moral and political and religious sense?
I get a sense that the debate will shift, and it will shift, and it's already been flagged that it's shift, that this is going to be revisited in Queensland. It will shift to who has the right to the eligibility criteria, essentially. And a big concern for many people in society is really around those who do not have decision-making capacity or might have fluctuating decision-making capacity and how you deal with that. So specifically, dementia is sort of brought up quite frequently in the conversation around voluntary assisted dying. No jurisdiction has gone there because they won't have decision-making capacity, so they've ruled that out. So I suspect the next stage of the debate will be, one, monitoring the safeguards, two, you know, is our eligibility criteria and process too restrictive? And you mentioned an article before, there's already debate happening in Victoria around, is it too restrictive? Is it not, do not enough people have access to this, who should have access to voluntary assisted dying? So I suspect that's the next frontier around this debate. In Queensland, I think it will move into, as we move into the implementation stage, this entity non-participation, institutional conscientious objection issue will be interesting to watch. And to see what happens in that space when that conflict sort of becomes a lived experience, and what guidelines they develop around that. So the policy detail will be interesting to watch, and that might be the first part of the debate in Queensland. Then it will no doubt broaden over time to who has eligibility. And it's interesting in terms of our consultation process. Just an observation, I found that in many of the forums we had, there seems to be a generational shift in attitudes towards voluntary assisted dying. And my observation was that particularly a large percentage of the baby boomers have a very strong sense of the right to die, and this strong sense of autonomy, and just having that decision to be able to have their life ended if they do reach that point. It's a very strong generational observation that I had during our whole consultation process. I can't verify that in terms of wider surveys, but I suspect there is a generational shift happening and an attitude that sort of is accompanied by an attitudinal a shift in Australia as well. And it is very much an individual rights-based approach and autonomy and control and choice. And that very much intersects with the whole voluntary assisted dying conversation.
And I think you're exactly right on the generational differences in my understanding of sort of demographic research on attitudes towards voluntary assisted dying by age. Younger generations tend to be far more supportive than older generations. And that's why something like this would have been probably a non-starter in the 1980s. But you know, now we can see public support, a majority of public support supports voluntary assisted dying compared to the past. I know I've taken up a lot of time, so I'll close by just one last question, though maybe it's a big one. What do you think we can draw from the debates over voluntary assisted dying for the relationship between law and religion more generally in Australia? For example, do you feel comfortable with how the representations from religious groups were received by the government? Were they treated respectfully? Is there anything sort of broader you'd like to say about what this shows in that area?
Yeah, I think that the big issue that's really emerged from this whole conversation, as we've experienced it in Queensland, is that broader question around in a democratic and pluralistic society, where you have significant not-for-profit faith-based organisations. What's going to be the intersection between upholding religious rights and religious groups to be able to give expression to their core beliefs in a public way, and therefore contribute in a distinctive way to a pluralistic society, and how that intersects with where there might be conflicts and competing rights? and how do we safeguard the integrity of practices and value that, while at the same time recognizing, yes, it's not about everybody sharing the religious group's beliefs. People have a right to different beliefs, and they have a right to access legal services and for different laws that might conflict with different religious perspectives. That should be right in a pluralistic society. But at the same time, how do you safeguard religious practices? And it's a complicated issue, and there's sort of extremes on either side of the debate. But for a religious, from a religious perspective, it's not simply something that is a private belief. It's clearly something that's very public. It's lived out in social services. It's given social expression and has throughout Australian history. A lot of our community services and health services are being built upon the activities of religious groups. So how do you actually grapple with those issues? And for religious organisations, it's a big question around the integrity of living out their values as they get larger and larger and more dependent upon government funding, and then that intersection of the law and right to give expression of that. I think that's going to be an interesting ongoing debate. And that's, you know, the voluntary assisted dying is only one element of that. You've got a whole other array of issues around religious freedoms and a whole lot of issues there, which are very complicated. So we recognise the complexities and how we intersect with that. And I suppose for religious entities to recognise that they are one voice out of many voices, so we clearly have a shift. They're no longer the dominant voice and might no longer as influential. They're one of many voices. So how do we engage the public space, the political space, with a posture of humility, I think is probably needed, but also at the same time in a considerate and rigorous way as well, that's not simply about abandoning the public space as well, because if we do abandon the public space, there's a loss to the broader society and a loss to the pluralistic society. Pluralistic society is, I think, best when we do have these tensions and these competing dialogues around an array of issues and continue to grapple with these competing rights. It's dangerous if we just have this abandonment and we no longer have a significant contribution within broader society.
Well, I agree completely. Those are profound words to close on. I very much appreciate you coming on the show. I really appreciated the compassion and the insight from your report and the conversation today. And it's definitely helped me understand the issue much more deeply. And I'm sure it would do the same for our listeners. So, Adam, thank you very much for coming on today.
Jeremy, my pleasure.
Listeners, if you have questions, comments, or topic suggestions, please email me at jeremy.patrick@usq.edu.au. I'll be back in 2 months with another episode of Law and Religion Down Under. See you then.